3. The Stars Come Out, 1980 to 1985. Pam Norris, writer. I have my personal conspiracy theory, which is that whoever came in after Lorne and the original cast was going to be killed, because, you know, you can't replace the Beatles. Somebody thought, well, we'll just let things get extremely bad, and then when we pull it back up a little bit afterward, it'll be considered a triumph. Barbara Gallagher, NBC Vice President. I said to Gene Demanian, look, I think you can have it, but if I were you, I wouldn't take it. First of all, the network is going to jump on you like a bad suit. They'll want to cut the budget, I can tell you right now, and they're going to cut it to the bone. They have been waiting all this time to get even with Lorne. I knew that because after they had squeezed Lorne at the beginning, he told me he was going to let them have it when it became a hit, and he did. He started demanding things, and when you're a hit, you get them, especially when you have advertisers scrambling to be part of the show. I remember telling Gene, any producer who comes in here now is doomed to fail. It's not going to work. Gene Dumanian, executive producer. I had to get an all-new cast and all-new writers in 2.5 months. When I took over the show, the first thing they did was cut my budget. The budget under Lorne had gotten up to $1 million a show. They cut my budget to $350,000, as I recall, and I was supposed to do the same show for that amount of money. I don't know this for a fact, but it would seem to me that if a woman could actually mount a show and get it done in such a short time, it minimized the importance of those who preceded her. And nobody liked that. So I was attacked viciously. How dare I take this job? How dare I think I can do the show? Most of that was said by men. You have to remember, the show had been biased against women for a long time.
Alan Zweibel, writer. When we left, I remember Gilda would call me up on Tuesday nights at 2 in the morning, and we'd still be up because our bodies for 5 years had been up all night on Tuesday, staying up and writing. Lorne Michaels, executive producer. I never watched Gene's show. I didn't watch it when Dick was running it either. I never watched it that whole time, not once. It would have been too painful. I didn't have anything to do with the show, so I didn't feel compromised. To walk away clean is at least to have your honor intact, and I felt I'd taken the honorable way out. The Gene Dumanian era, all 10 months of it, marked the first but not last time Saturday Night Live's very survival was at stake. After 5 years of enormous and trend-setting popularity, replete with breakout stars, iconic characters, and now classic sketches, the show zapped back to square one in 1980 following the departure of Lorne Michaels, the cast he had assembled, and all the original writers. Viewers may not have been immersed in the backstage politics, but they couldn't help noticing that the quality of the show plummeted. Many in the business thought Dumanian lacked the experience and expertise necessary for the job. She was further beset by skullduggery among staff members, who wanted the usurper ousted from the throne almost the instant she assumed it. NBC was doing badly in prime time, and within weeks of Dumanian's accession, Saturday Night Live was added to the network's list of gaping wounds requiring medical attention. An audience that expected to see fresh new Gildas, Belushis, Chevys, and Aykroyds refused to settle for the paltry replacements that initially dominated Dumanian's cast. Charles Rocket, Denny Dillon, Gail Mathias, Anne Risley. Saturday Night Live fell apart in less time than it took to come together 5 years earlier. The show still had no real competition in its time period. "Our competition is asleep," as one cast member put it. But its predicament was perhaps worse than if it had. Saturday Night Live was competing against the memory of itself, and losing. Joe Piscopo, cast member. When we came in, after Lorne and all the original guys had left, the offices were completely empty. They even cleaned all the desks out. The pencils were gone. And when I tell you pencils, I'm not exaggerating. The offices were all reconfigured. It was like somebody came up there and just kind of bombed everything out, man. It was pretty wild. Andrew Kurtzman, writer. I think we had the feeling of being a bit beside the point. Coming in the aftermath of this big cultural juggernaut, the first 5 years of the show, we were a little like the guy with the handcart behind the locomotive. Saturday Night Live had its own mythology in place. The big show had left town. We had a certain cheeseball feel. It was hard work to book guest hosts for a while. Pamela Sue Martin's on the bubble, but she might say yes. That kind of thing. You never really had the feeling that you could open your suit on the observation deck of the Empire State Building and yell, "I own this town!" Because people were always saying, "Yeah, but you weren't nearly as good as the original show." Bill Murray, cast member. I knew Jean and liked her. I'd known her a long time. I'm not sure that she did the worst job in the world. They gave her no credit for trying. She had great connections in the music world, and she got some great acts for the show. They didn't really give her a full shot. She did find Eddie Murphy and a couple other people who were really talented. They just needed some confidence. She was struggling, and they were having a hard time getting quality hosts. So I called up, and I said, "I can't get arrested. Is there any way I could work on your show?" So I went in there. It was a tough week. We worked really hard writing and rewriting, and the show turned out good, and I thought, this could work. The cast saw how hard you have to work to do that show. I don't think most of them ever worked that hard before. They were going through their first brush with fame, even at the level they were at. The world just wasn't ready for a brand new group, so it was incredibly tough for them. Andrew Smith, writer. If you want to get philosophical about the problems of the subsequent years after the first 5 years, the actors were so cognizant of the success of the group that had gone before them, that Chevy and John and Gilda had broken out into these huge stars, that they began to have one eye on the audience and on the fact that Steven Spielberg might be watching, and only one eye on being funny. The first group that came through before me didn't know how big they were going to be, so they were much freer and much more open, and thus, I thought, a lot funnier than the subsequent people. As soon as SNL, or the not-ready-for-primetime players, became a launching pad, then it wasn't about just the comedy that was happening there. It was about future earnings or future career moves. And that's the kind of cancer that is always threatening to eat away at the comedy on the show, even to this day. God knows, if I was an actor, I would feel the same way. It's like a loss of innocence. You can't not think about the fact that if you make the right moves on Saturday Night Live, you could become a huge, huge star. And so, therefore, when somebody wants you to play a turtle or something like that, you say, "Well, I don't know. I don't think that would look good." I bet if those original guys knew how big they were going to be, they probably wouldn't have done Killer Bees. Gilbert Gottfried, cast member. Back then it was a big deal that the cast was changing and the producer was changing. Before we even hit the air, there were already articles being written in every paper and every magazine saying disaster was coming, and how dare they continue Saturday Night Live with a different cast. And that this producer is not equipped to do the job, and this cast is terrible. David Sheffield, writer. A friend of mine named Patrick was auditioning as an actor on the show. Patrick got his big break as a men's room attendant at Studio 54. He worked the stalls there a bit. He knew everybody. I think he actually had an agent at that point. He got an audition and called me and said if I would write some material for him, he would see the producers got it. I wrote a couple of sketches, thinking nothing would come of it. He called back and said, "They love your stuff, man. They want to hire you." I said, "Who wants to hire me?" He said, "I don't know, some guy with glasses." That guy turned out to be Gene Dumanian's producer. Chris Albrecht, agent, comedy club manager. I became an agent at ICM in 1980. My client list as an agent included people like Jim Carrey, Whoopi Goldberg, Billy Crystal, Dana Carvey, Paul Rodriguez, Sandra Bernhardt, Kenan Ivory Wayans, Joe Piscopo, and other people. I actually ended up putting a lot of people on that very ill-fated Gene Dumanian one-year tenure. The fact that there were new opportunities for Saturday Night Live, that they were going to recast this quickly legendary show, made for very exciting times. Barry Blaustein, writer. When I got there the first day and I was taking off my jacket, a writer from the office next door came in and said, "I want you to sign a petition to get rid of Gene Dumanian." It was total turmoil already. I think one of the reasons David Sheffield and I survived that year is we stayed away from the turmoil as much as possible. We just concentrated on the writing and not the politics. Everyone was bitching and no one was writing. Dave had worked in local television in Mississippi. I had worked on the Mike Douglas show in L.A. We were hired separately. We met on the show. We were the last writers hired that year, as a matter of fact, and I think we both realized what a tremendous break and opportunity this was for us. We were surrounded by people going, "I don't need this job. I don't need this job. To hell with this." And I was thinking, "I do need this job. This is the big break. This is the big opportunity."
Gene Dumanian. I made Barry and David write together. Barry's Jewish humor was wonderful, and David's Southern humor was great as well, but very different. And they were both very smart guys. I thought between the two of them, they'd come up with something that was really original. I think they're still together on things. I was also very lucky to have Pam Norris as one of my writers. She was a terrific writer, and quite an individual. Pam Norris. I had been at the Harvard Lampoon, and this was before the Harvard Lampoon was a rocket, when people working there were goofing off, basically, when you were supposed to be doing something else, and instead you were goofing off with the Harvard Lampoon. But there was a writer on the original show, Jim Downey, who had seen some of my stuff in the Harvard Lampoon, and he encouraged me to think about going to the show, and he put in a good word for me with Gene Dumanian. I was working on Wall Street that summer and had not finished Harvard, so I wrote a few sketches and sent them over there, got interviewed, and got the job. I finally finished college during the writer's strike of 1981, when I went back to Harvard. Actually, my diploma was mailed to me. I didn't get my Harvard diploma handed to me in Harvard Yard. It was handed to me by a production assistant at Saturday Night Live with very little ceremony.
David Sheffield. I have mixed feelings about Jean. She gave me my first big break at the networks, and for that I'm eternally grateful. And she had an eye for talent, like finding Joe Piscopo. Her background was in talent, because she was the talent booker for the show, so you could see the network's logic. They were losing Lorne, and they wanted to maintain continuity. But Jean knew zilch about comedy. She didn't have a clue. It was almost a lesson in how not to run a comedy show. She had a knack for pitting people against each other that was just antithetical to comedy. I don't know why she thought that was a good way to work. She actually started rivalries where none existed before, among the writers and cast, thinking somehow the strongest would prevail. That was not a formula for comedy. Joe Piscopo. I didn't want the job as a cast member on the show, and I told my agent at the time, Chris Albrecht, "I can't do the show, man. I'd be taking a pay cut, because I was making more money doing commercials, just being the working stiff," and I said, "I don't want to do this." But he said, "You've got to do it. It's Saturday Night Live." Harry Shearer, cast member. I went to Gene and said, "I know you're not a fan of Lorne's, and you know that I'm not a fan of Lorne's, so you're not going to have a loyalist sitting around saying, 'Lorne wouldn't have done it this way.'" I told her, "I'm willing to come work on your show. I think you really need to get some people around us, if you want me to come, who've got some experience, because you're not going to have the slack that Lorne had at the beginning. You're going to have to hit the ground running." I suggested Christopher Guest and a couple others as people who should come in, and she said, "I'm not really sure I want people who know what they're doing." At that point, I knew I wasn't coming back. Gilbert Gottfried. If they just did reviews of the show and said it sucked, they would have been right. But the articles were like a whole other thing. It became like, even though the writers going in were considered terrible writers because she hired them, the minute she'd fire them, all of a sudden they became great writers. There was even an article in People magazine about three writers as if, because they were fired, that made them great. And they talk about how terrible she was. It was a weird period.
Jean Dumanian. Even the censors became very, very tough on me. I couldn't say something like, rolling off a log. They thought there was an innuendo there. Then you think about what we got away with from 75 to 80. I mean, we were saying things like golden shower, and they didn't do anything about it. But the censors really became so tough on us. It was incredible. Pam Norris. I think a lot of people were there saying, why couldn't I have been on The Good Show? And it's like, why don't you make a good show yourself? One person has a tremendous amount of power at that show. At least they did when I was there. One person can write a great sketch. One person can write two great sketches. One person can write three great sketches. I mean, if you can sit down and write, you know, 70 minutes of pretty good material, you could have the whole show. So I just felt that when writers complained about things, they could have been writing something.
Gilbert Gottfried. Basically, on that show, they hire you as a performer and expect you to be an unpaid writer. They didn't use me that much. I think the low point of what the writers thought of me was in one sketch. It was a funeral scene, and they used me as the corpse. Barry Blaustein. Some people say Woody Allen was kind of a hidden producer of the show that year, because he was a friend of Gene's and he supposedly had an advisor role. But we never saw him.
Jean Dumanian. Woody Allen was not involved in the show in any way. I say that unequivocally. You can put that to rest. He was not involved at all, aside from the fact that he was a friend. Pam Norris. I lived in those offices for a long time. They had a great shower, and they had a color TV and food and soda, and I found myself staying there later and later every night, and finally I just said, oh, what the hell, and I moved in. I don't think anybody knew that I was living there. What made it really great is that they had this bank of metal filing cabinets down next to where the secretaries typed the scripts that had every sketch that had ever been written for the show filed away in them. And this is every sketch ever written, not just every sketch ever aired. So I had the access to what seemed like the Rosetta Stone to me. Every sketch written and rejected for the first show. Every sketch written and rejected for the second show. It was all this very seminal material by the people who became, you know, gods and goddesses. And that was an amazing experience. Jean Dumanian. My numbers weren't bad at all, considering it was a new show with a whole new cast. Some of them, I think, were higher than the last of Lorne's, because the last year of Lorne's regime was not as good as one would expect. They were all thinking about what the future was going to be.
Barry Blaustein. One executive from the network called me and Dave into his office and said, I want to show you something. And he shows us this footage of a boa constrictor eating a mouse. And he says, this is exactly what we should be doing on the show. It was such a bizarre meeting.
Jean Dumanian. I was so busy doing my job that I never saw any writing on the wall. I thought the shows were getting better. We were all working so hard. I was really not aware of anything going on behind the scenes. That's how unaware I was. I was putting in 18 hours a day, easy. I knew I could do it.
Joe Piscopo. I could never describe to you in words how painful those first 10 months really were. You just knew that this was America's favorite television show, and yet here we were taking it right into the toilet. Saturday night after the show, it was pretty much like a funeral, like you were mourning. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Did we really do this? Oh, my God. And then we had to turn it around on Monday all over again. Hopeless as the situation seemed, Dumanian actually had a tremendous secret weapon in her arsenal, so secret that, sadly for her, even she didn't realize it. This was a young, brash cast member who spent most of the season in small bit parts, except in the 17th floor offices, where he kept co-workers continuously entertained. He was not a great white hope. Au contraire. Definitely great, however. His day would come, but not in time to save the very doomed Dumanian. Neil Levy, Talent Coordinator. Jean had cast an actor named Robert Townsend to be the black guy on the show, and then this guy Eddie Murphy started calling me. It sounded like from a payphone, and I told him, "I'm sorry, we're not auditioning anymore." But he called again the next day, and he would go into this whole thing about how he had 18 brothers and sisters, and they were counting on him to get this job. And he would call every day for about a week, and I finally decided I would use him as an extra. So I brought him in for an audition, and he did a 4-minute piece of him acting out three characters up in Harlem. One guy was instigating the others to fight, and it was absolutely brilliant. The timing, the characterizations, talent was just shooting out of him. And I went, "Wow." And I took him in to Gene, and I said, "Gene, you've got to see this." He did his audition for Gene, and she sent him out of the room, and she said to me, "Well, he's good, but I like Robert Townsend better." And I went nuts, you know, I threatened to quit. At that point, there were so many mistakes, I was actually heartbroken, because I'd been on the original show, and it went beyond mistakes for me. It was like there was a spirit that I knew that existed in that show, and she had no idea what that was, and she was missing it. She would choose Robert Townsend over Eddie Murphy. Not that Robert Townsend isn't great, a good actor, but the difference in terms of what was right for that show was so obvious, and compounded with all the other crap that was going on, I couldn't take it. So she hired Eddie as a featured player just to spite me. He was the only featured player that year. He should have been a regular. She hired him only because I pressured her, and then to spite me, she wouldn't make him a regular. She only wanted to hire one black actor, and Townsend hadn't signed his contract yet, so she signed Eddie. The point of it is that she didn't want him, and she's been claiming that she discovered him for years. Now Ebersol, I heard, is claiming he discovered him, and Ebersol wasn't even on the show when Eddie came. But Ebersol used to take credit for all the not-ready-for-primetime players, so that doesn't surprise me. James Downey, Writer. When I first met Eddie Murphy, I was up there visiting Jean. I'd recommended a couple of writers to her, and Eddie was hanging around. He'd been hired as a featured player, but he would just go around to everyone's office and make everybody laugh. He made me laugh the first day I met him. And he was just so clearly the funniest person on the floor. I remember saying to Gene Dumanian, "You've got to use this kid, Eddie Murphy. You've got to put him on." And I remember her going, "He's not ready."
Gene Dumanian. I didn't have enough of a budget to put Eddie on as a member of the cast, because I had already selected the cast when I auditioned him. So I let him be a featured player. They said okay. After the first two shows, I said to the administration, "Listen, you have to make this guy a member of the cast. You just have to. He's so great." He was 18 when I found him. They finally said okay. And then I found out from Eddie that a network vice president was trying to tell him to leave the show and that he'd get a sitcom on NBC. But Eddie wouldn't do it.
Neil Levy. One night, Jean was 5 minutes short in the show. She had nothing, whereas Lorne always had something in the bag, a short film, something so you go over instead of under. If you're under, you're left with nothing, and she had nothing. This is 15 minutes before the end of the show when Audrey Dickman, who was timing it, realized it was going to run short. Dave Wilson was sitting there saying, "What are we going to do, Jean?" And she was pacing and she didn't know what to do. And I remembered Eddie's monologue from his audition like 3 months earlier. So I said, "Why don't you see if Eddie can do the monologue that he did for his audition?" And she said, "Oh no, that won't work." And then, about a minute later, she said, "Why don't we get Eddie and he'll do the audition piece?" And they laughed in the booth, and I said, "Yeah, okay, great." And I ran up, and I found Eddie, and I asked him. And his face lit up like he'd been waiting for this moment his whole life. And he said, "Yeah." So we rushed him downstairs, and he did that piece. And in another week or two, I think, he was made a regular. Dominion's fate was sealed on a night in late February 1981. Charlie Rocket was playing the victim of a shooting in a show-length spoof of the then-popular primetime soap opera Dallas and its famous Who Shot J.R. cliffhanger. Mere minutes before the 1 a.m. closing time, Rocket, in a wheelchair ostensibly because of injuries suffered in the assassination attempt, complained about having been shot and said, for all those watching at home and in the studio to hear, "I'd like to know who the fuck did it." Fred Silverman, NBC president. Dumanian got out of control. I think the thing that really did it was that there was a kid on the show by the name of Charlie Rocket, and one night he did the unpardonable. He said the fuck word on live television, and it went out to the whole network. And that was it. I said, "Who needs this aggravation?" I think we'd made the decision even before then that we had to get rid of her. This woman was a train wreck, and the shows were just not watchable. Gilbert Gottfried. I was sitting in the offices talking to Eddie one day when all of a sudden some woman comes in and says, "Eddie, somebody from NBC wants to speak to you." And he gets on the phone and he goes, "Yes, yeah, okay, no, no, I won't tell anybody." And he hangs up. Before the phone even hits the cradle, he tells me, "Gene Dumanian's been fired." The next day or so, Gene Dumanian was going to make this announcement to the cast and crew that she'd been fired. But by then, everyone knew it. And it was weird because they had this improv teacher named Del Close hired there for some reason. And so she calls everyone into her office, and everyone's sitting there, and she's tearfully telling everyone that she's been fired and everything, but that she wishes everyone the best and whatnot. And in the midst of all this, all of a sudden they walk in with a cake singing Happy Birthday, and it's put in front of this Del Close guy. It was a very surreal situation.
Gene Dumanian. I was down in Erwin Siegelstein's office for maybe 4 hours, trying to convince him to please give us more money for the show. But I also found out that some of the people on my show that I'd hired and helped were going downstairs and talking to the brass behind my back. I don't know this for a fact, but I was told. They were really sabotaging the show and me. He had sent me some wine when I got the show, as a congratulatory thing. But before I told anybody anything, I broke open about 5 bottles of wine and I said, "Everybody come on in. I have something to tell you, and don't be upset about it, because I'm not upset about it. I just want to tell you you've done a wonderful job. I think you're all terrific. I want you all to go on and try to make the best of it. But they told me that I've served my purpose, and that's it for me." And that was it. In retrospect, I think really they put me in there on purpose, because after a very successful show, the second guy usually fails, and then the third guy comes in, takes over, and succeeds. Pam Norris. I've sort of learned in the subsequent 20 years I've been in show business that people just aren't that clever. And sometimes things that look like clever schemes are just people stumbling over their own feet.
Chris Albrecht. In retrospect, what Gene did was just take the hit that was going to come to anybody who was going to try to recast that show with new stars. I liked Gene. I really did. She was very direct. She had bad press and not a lot of support from the network. I'm not so sure it's not tough being a woman in that job.
Gene Dumanian. I must say, my friends were very happy that part of my life had ended, because they thought I was working so hard and I was so determined that they were concerned about my health. But I was really disappointed. I thought Brandon and the network were going to stick behind me, and they didn't at all. If you read the newspapers, they didn't support me at all. So that's when I kind of discovered that I had been used. I don't consider that show a failure for myself, I consider it truly an accomplishment.
Gilbert Gottfried. After I was fired from the show, I kind of was like walking around with this feeling that everybody was looking at me, going, "Oh, that's the guy who was on A Bad Season on Saturday night." I hated it for the longest time when someone would recognize me from Saturday night. Network chief Brandon Tartikoff felt an emotional attachment to the show and desperately wanted to keep it on the air, even when other network executives advocated cutting the umbilical and letting it float off into space. In his desperation, Tartikoff turned to old pal and fellow Yalie, Dick Ebersol, a man who had never produced a comedy show or professionally written a sketch in his life, and who, in fact, had not so long ago been fired from an NBC executive post by Tartikoff's bellicose boss, Fred Silverman. But Brandon's friend had also been present and instrumental in the creation of Saturday Night Live. The embalming process was halted, and shock therapy began. Michaels and Ebersol had little in common when it came to style and personality, but they did have this. Each thought the other wanted too much credit for the creation of Saturday Night Live. It took both of them working together at the very outset to bring Saturday Night Live to life, but once it premiered, Michaels would have preferred Ebersol to have disappeared. When Ebersol was asked to rescue the show after the Dumanian cliffhanger, he wisely sought Michaels's approval and blessing before taking over. That meant that creative people loyal to Michaels wouldn't feel they were committing heresy or poking him in the eye if they went to work on the Ebersol version, a problem that had reputedly helped sink Dumanian. Though Michaels and Ebersol weren't close, they were both close to Tartikoff, who felt the show represented more to the network than a profit center. It was a badge of honor, too. And Tartikoff was one network executive who cared about prestige in addition to profits. For Ebersol, the situation was rife with irony. After helping create the show in 1974 and then being sentenced to a certain anonymity for his efforts, he would be called back to keep the show going by his old nemesis, Fred Silverman, the guy who fired him. And Tartikoff, the longtime friend who did the actual recruitment of Ebersol, had become head of programming when Ebersol was passed over for the job. What Ebersol lacked in imagination, he made up for in iron-willed determination. Swinging a baseball bat or just lugging it around like some swollen scepter, Ebersol pitched a ferocious battle to make Saturday Night Live a hit again. He would save the show, whatever it took. Dick Ebersol, NBC executive. I remember Gene's last show. It was just beset with problems. It was the night that Charlie Rocket said fuck on the air. And I stayed up with Brandon quite late, and he asked me again, would you consider fixing it? I said I would come as long as I could hide inside 30 Rock, watching on the internal system how the show works, the camera blocking, watch to see if the talent is mature enough to save a piece, because I could think of a million pieces from the earliest days of the show which absolutely sucked on Wednesday and had at least an 80% life by the time they went on the air. The talent was that good, and some of the writers were good enough to fix it. And I said, number one, only if it goes off the air. This is not something you can fix in a week. And number two, I get to pick what airs all the weeks it's off the air. I wanted to put on four or five of the greatest shows from the first 5 years, just to get people back in the sense of, this show was about something. Actually, I think I said to take it off for 2 months. So this meeting was set up in Fred Silverman's apartment on a Sunday afternoon, and Fred is so uncomfortable to have me there, because there is no love lost between the two of us, and I just did not respect him. So they go through this whole thing about will I do it, and I said, yeah, under certain circumstances. And we argued and debated, and finally it became 5 weeks that the show would be off the air. I didn't want a lot of money. I just wanted a guarantee that I would get serious commitments for every year that we managed to keep the show alive. And this would be stuff I would develop myself. That's how Friday Night Videos and the Bob Costas talk show later came to be. And finally, I said, there was one last condition. We don't have a deal until I have a conversation with Lorne. I'm not doing this show unless Lorne wants it to survive. And Fred felt like he had really been set up. He wasn't happy, but he grudgingly said, All right, but I want to know where this is tomorrow. I called Lorne, and we went to dinner and wound up over at his apartment, and we sat there basically all night talking. And I honestly believe it's one of the 5 or 6 most important nights in the history of the show, because I'd hired Lorne when we were first sitting in L.A., putting it all together, back in the spring of 75. I said, "Lorne, I'm willing to do this only if you'll bless it." He just had to put the word out. Anyway, around 5 or 6 in the morning, he finally said, "I do want to see it go on. I won't go back, but I will completely support it." And that word was out by the time Lorne woke up the next afternoon. Lorne Michaels. Michael O'Donohue's manager, a guy named Barry Secunda, explained to me the simple fact that Michael had no money, and Michael was very proud, but he really needed a job. Barry wanted to know if I would speak to Ebersol on his behalf, which I did. Of course, the very first thing Michael did was to meet with everyone and say, "We have to obliterate Lorne Michaels. We have to pour gasoline on him and set him afire." And then he burned some picture of me. Pretty soon after, he was fired. I love Michael, and I would have expected no less. It wasn't as if I helped him thinking I'd get the thanks of a grateful nation. After all, it was Michael. Of the three of us, the senior 3 males in the first months of the show, Chevy went on to fame and stardom, I got what I got, and Michael wanted more performance time. The rewards for him weren't as great as he felt he deserved. Dick Ebersol. Lorne told me I should hire Michael. He persuaded me it would be a good idea. O'Donohue thought the show was shit, and he thought the people involved were shit. He wanted to give it a Viking funeral. He was going to be, quote, in charge of the writing staff. Since Ebersol was determined that the show regain its lost luster as well as its lost ratings, it may seem odd for him to have installed O'Donohue as head writer, especially since O'Donohue was so fond of proclaiming Saturday Night Live dead. But what made him attractive to Ebersol is that he represented a link to Lorne Michaels and his era, and Ebersol was anxious to establish such links. Few were available, but O'Donohue had been a very conspicuous and productive presence during those first 5 years. Ebersol wanted to be a member of that club, and O'Donohue seemed one way, however risky, to gain acceptance. It would be a recurring theme of Ebersol's stewardship. Neil Levy. Dick wanted to be Lorne, basically. The first words out of Dick's mouth to the writers was, he broke them into 2 teams at the first meeting and said, "Here's what we're going to do. I have 2 ideas, and we're going to make short films. And half of you are going to do this one idea, and the other half are going to do this idea about a bag lady." I forget what the first idea was. And the writers kind of scratched their heads. A bag lady? What's funny about that? But Dick said to go and do it. So the team of writers for The Bag Lady did whatever their short film was, and it was shot, and Denny Dillon was in it, and it came back, and it was a disaster, totally unusable. And O'Donohue was sitting there, smoking one of those long brown cigarettes with his hat and sunglasses on, and he said, "Well, it's all there on the screen." Something like that. It was a huge embarrassment to Dick, because it was the first thing he had asked for, and it was his idea, and it was horrible. So he says to Michael, "Is there anything we can do to make it work?" O'Donohue says, "If you took out all the sound and used outtakes of Denny as the bag lady sitting there on a bench, maybe we could put some funny voiceovers or something, but I don't think so." And Ebersol jumped on it, and he said, "Great, that's great!" And he looked at me, and he said, "Neil, get the writers together and tell them we want lines for passers-by to say about a bag lady." I didn't realize I'd just been handed the bag. I went and told all the writers and came back and reported to Dick they were all working on it. So now they've finished their lines, and Dick sends me to collect them. I show them to him. He crosses a few off. He says, "Great, now get the actors and get it done." All right. So I told the actors what we had to do. Basically, I didn't want to do this. I was just following instructions on what Dick wanted. I didn't realize I was suddenly producing this piece. The night of Dick's first show, Lorne comes, and it was like God visiting, you know. "Make way, make way, he's in the building." Dick even let Lorne sit at his own desk on the 9th floor. And I come in, and Dick looks at me and says, "Oh, Lorne, your cousin made this great Bag Lady film." And I was about to say something, and he told me to leave the room. He said, "I need this list for tomorrow, and I need this and that." And I said, "But Lorne..." And Dick said, "Just go." And of course, the Bag Lady was just a total embarrassment. I don't know why he even bothered showing it. It made it as far as dress rehearsal. That nearly killed me. I didn't get a chance to talk to Lorne about it, actually. I don't think I ever mentioned it to him, that I was set up and had nothing to do with it. Bob Tischler, writer. I was actually a record producer, had worked with the Blues Brothers, and had worked with a lot of the people from Saturday Night Live on the National Lampoon Radio Hour, which I had produced. That's how Michael O'Donohue knew me. He said, "Come to Saturday Night Live." I said, "Well, you know, I kind of have this other career going." And he said, "It'll be fun. And by the way, the show is just going to go down anyway, so don't worry about having to be stuck on the show." And he actually described it as a death ship. Tim Kazurinsky, cast member. John Belushi pretty much got me hired and recommended me for Saturday Night Live. The evening that Dick Ebersol came to Chicago and hired me, I assumed I was being hired as a writer. I'd never thought of myself as an actor. And then, as he was wrapping up, he said, "You have your after card, right?" And I said, "Why do I need an after card if I'm going to write?" He said, "No, no, you're going to be in the cast." I said, "You want me to act?" He said, "Yeah, I didn't even know you wrote." I was completely stunned. I was driving home in my Volkswagen going, "That's weird," because I'd never really thought of myself as an actor. Joe Piscopo. They kept Eddie and me and fired everybody else. O'Donohue said to me, "Piscopo, I'm not crazy about you, but that Sinatra thing is not bad." And in essence, he told me, "You're going to have to prove yourself to me." Then he put us all in a room. O'Donohue came in, spray-painted "Danger" on the wall, and said, "This is what the show lacks."
Pam Norris. I remember the day Michael was writing "Danger" on that wall. The spray can stopped working halfway through, and I was like on my back laughing because he'd just written "Dan" on the wall, and the spray can temporarily stopped working. I thought, oh my God, this guy's going to go down in history writing "Dan" on the wall. But he shook it a few times, and it started up again.
Neil Levy. Dick told me that if I could get Catherine O'Hara to come to New York, he would let me stay on. It was sleazy, but I thought, well, I can do it. So I went and asked Catherine O'Hara. She wasn't really interested, but I talked to her and she came down. Then she saw the flaming Viking ship going under and she went, "Uh-oh, gotta run." Dick Ebersol. Meantime, I'd hired Catherine O'Hara. It had taken a lot to lure her because live was not her style. So in that very first meeting with Michael, when he was telling everybody the show is shit, and spraying all over the writer's wall the word "danger," it really scared Catherine O'Hara. Scared her right off the show. She packed up her stuff and went home to Canada that night. Tim Kazurinsky. O'Donohue had this vision of taking the show down. He wanted to destroy the show. His motto was "Viking Death Ship. Let's all go down in the Viking Death Ship." I grew up in the slums, you know, starving, and I'm thinking, can't we, like, keep it afloat just until I can buy a condo? Yeah, he wrote "Danger" on the wall. It was, like, carefully orchestrated. He was a drama queen. But I loved Michael. He was great. He did bring on Terry Southern. Terry had been one of America's great writers. But he was not a sketch comedy writer. It's absurd. I don't know if he ever wrote anything that actually got on the air. But he ran a fine wet bar out of his office. It was a really odd time because it seemed like that first year, half of them really worked at trying to have it go up in smoke. In retrospect, maybe O'Donohue had the right idea.
Rosie Schuster, writer. I was having this big fight with Clotworthy about a sketch called The Taboosters, which is just a normal, regular family, and they have lots of rules and stuff, but no taboos. And I couldn't win this argument. And then afterwards, when I showed the censor out of my office, I saw that Terry Southern, who was writing on the show at the time, had left a Hustler magazine sitting there with this big female pink genitalia flashing right in the censor's face. I had no idea. That was Terry's idea of being hilarious. It was pretty funny afterwards. I thought, oh my God, no wonder the censor was mad.